Martech Stacks, episode 13, with Nick Roberts. Brought to you by Content Cal. Plan, collaborate on, approve, and publish your content in one simple and intuitive calendar interface. This is Martech Stacked, the weekly show that delves into the what, which, why, and how of marketing technology. I'm your host, David Bain, and each episode I'll be chatting with a top marketer or a top technologist about what Martech they use, which are their top tools, why they use the tools that they do, and how they integrate everything together as part of their overarching content marketing strategy and Martech stack. I'm joined today by a man who's the marketing director for a company that provides crowd testing quality assurance for the likes of Facebook, Canva, and Microsoft. He's an experienced B2B SaaS marketer and a demand generation expert. Welcome to Martech Stacked, Nick Roberts.
Thanks, David. Appreciate that. It was a great intro. I like the way you described me. I'll take that.
Well, thank you very much. Hopefully it doesn't taper down from here, you know, and we keep it on a decent level.
Let's hope not. Start high.
Absolutely, yeah. So great to have you on, Nick. You can, of course, find you over at globalapptesting.com. So can you please explain what Global App Testing does and how you use marketing technology to make it better?
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to. So, I mean, in a nutshell, you kind of hit the nail on the head, but we are a remote on-demand QA testing company. And we do that through the power of a crowd of 40,000 plus testers around the world. So that means companies like you mentioned, Facebook, can test, you know, the latest version of their app in Brazil without sending their Brazilian or without sending a team to Brazil or setting up a team in Brazil. And we basically use a blend of humans and machines to allow companies to release high quality software at speed and scale. You know, traditionally QA has been something that has kind of been relegated to the end of the process when companies make software. And, you know, we shift that now much earlier in the process. It's much cheaper and more effective to find a bug earlier in the process than it is when it's already out in the wild. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of in a nutshell what we do. From a marketing technology perspective, it really underpins everything we do from an acquisition perspective. Almost all the acquisition we do is powered in some part through our MarTech stack. And I like to think of it as, you know, the better our acquisition funnels, the better customers we get on our platform. If we get better customers on our platform, then that means that we can get better usage in our product itself. And then if we get better usage, then we can obviously build a better product through customer feedback. So it's really like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. I make it sound like it's all interconnected really neatly and tightly, but I'd be lying if I said that does. But really what it does is it makes us really good at acquiring customers.
I'm sure it's blended better than it was last year, but perhaps next year it'll be blended even better.
Oh, I hope so.
It's an ever improving journey, really, for all of us. And one thing that you said as part of your kind of introduction there was it's a blend of humans and machines that that power your service there. So is it more machines now than it used to be, and are you moving towards just machines, or will there always be humans as an essential part of what you do?
So I like to think of it like the self-driving car, right? If someone had just said, "Hey, we've got a self-driving car," everything's got to change now. Everyone's got to be in a self-driving car. Our streets aren't ready for it. Pedestrians aren't ready for it. The technology would be kind of strange. People wouldn't know how to use it, etc. And so it's kind of that same thought process with autonomous testing, as we call it. So as you continue to, you know, machines can do only so much, right? And it only takes the input from somebody else and tells it what to do. So from the human perspective, what the humans do, what our testers do really is find the edge case, the really meaty, the real stuff that machines can't test and can't find. A great example of that is we're working with a large company, and they were struggling in Southeast Asia and in Indonesia specifically. They were having real big troubles with signups. They couldn't figure out what was going on, and they asked us to run some tests in Indonesia. All of their automated tests were fine, no problems there. So they couldn't figure out what the problem was. And ultimately, it boiled down to the fact that on the signup page, it was asking for the user's first name and their last name. Well, in Indonesia, a large percentage of the population just don't have a surname. They don't have a last name. So the sign up, and it's a required field. So if it's a required field and you can't sign up for it, your automation test says, yeah, it passed. The field's there. Great. But you can't program for those kinds of nuances. And that's what the human element of it is. I don't think the human element will ever go away, at least not until, you know, we're full-on autonomous AI overlords take over, which hopefully is a long time away.
I'm sure the human role will change a bit, but always stay an important part of it. And I'm sure organizations that just rely on automation until the machines take over will probably be a little bit lesser in terms of their overall success than, I guess, organizations that incorporate the human instinct as well.
Definitely. Yeah. I think the companies that understand you can use it as a driver of growth, a high-quality product, I think they're the ones that really do get it and really do achieve the most success, at least from what we see.
So let's dive into your marketing technology. So starting off with number three, what are your top three tools in your current MarTech stack and why?
Great. So I think from me, my third most important piece is a platform called Databox. And Databox does a couple of different things for us. Databox is like our visual reporting representation layer. And it crosses more than just marketing. I mean, initially it was set up by marketing because marketing always gets the cool tools and that kind of stuff. But essentially, Databox allows us to take lots of different data from different places and present it in a nice visual way that is engaging for people. You know, people love to see a good graph, a good chart, a good dashboard. And what Databox has allowed us to do is really democratize access to what's going on in the business. So we have our OKRs in Databox. They're publicly available to anyone in the company, and they're generally updated in real time. So as long as you're piping in real-time data to those data boards and data boxes, you get insight into those specific areas. And that's really cool because, you know, now on Mondays, our senior leadership team automatically has, you know, where we are performance-wise, where we are trending, and where we might end the quarter regularly, automagically, as I like to call it.
So it's databox.com. According to Google, or at least the SERP result, it's a business analytics platform and KPI dashboards. It certainly looks like a great service there. What competing service would you say is most similar to this? Maybe something like segment.com?
Kind of. So Segment, you can pipe data from Segment in there. So I would say more along the lines of Gecko Board. Would be an example, or even kind of some of the functionality within Google Data Studio will provide that. What's really helpful, I think, is that you can get other people in the organization creating data boards and dashboards through simple connections, and it doesn't require someone to have, like, we have Tableau in the organization, which is great, but it doesn't require, you know, a lengthy training through Tableau and understanding all the different tables and all those things. You can just literally create custom metrics and put them in there. And then around the office, we've got TVs, you know, back when people used to be in the office, of course, we have TVs. And so, you know, you can display those wonderfully, and they're just really nicely formatted as well. So walking around the office, you get a good sense of what's happening at all times.
So I'm certainly familiar with Gecko Board as well, and I've seen them around different offices in London when I was allowed in. And so what about Databox makes it better for you than Gecko Board? Because it appears it has quite a bit of connectivity with lots of different platforms. Mm-hmm. Does it have more connectivity compared with Gecko Board?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've used both, and I think the big thing for me, the big win for me on Databox was the ease of use and the ease of being able to schedule kind of regular reporting. And by ease of use, I mean democratize it across the company, so that anybody, you know, if someone in our customer support function wanted to create a dashboard, for instance, they can easily do that, and they connect those simply. And the I just think it's those things that make it the absolute best way to go. It's formatted nicely for TVs as well, like I mentioned, which was a big deal. And the integrations work with our other stacks that we have as well.
Interesting. Okay. So I'll be interested to see if Databox, GeckoBoard, and other similar services actually adjust their unique proposition or core selling points, taking it away from TV dashboards to something else that works online. Yeah.
It's true. And I think you do see that already with the application of, oh, this is a business intelligence type of platform, right? It's like, oh, well, that's different than, you know, like a dashboard type program.
Okay. So that's Databox, tool number three for you. What is tool number two?
Tool number two is another multi-purpose tool which I use regularly. And once kind of people understood the application of it, it then became a company-wide thing. Well, and that's Zapier, or Zapier, depending on how you pronounce it. You know, for me, Zapier is the Swiss Army knife of, you know, of pretty much anything. And the reason that I chose that as my second most important piece is because you can essentially take whatever data you have, wherever you have it currently, and you can transform it and put it where you need it. And that sounds, oh, great, okay, whatever. But actually, it's super powerful because you are able to analyze things you might not be able to analyze in your current system. You can make it do things to keep people informed and updated, and it expands the functionality of all the other tools that you have. So so even with Databox, number three, some of the data that comes into Databox is actually piped in through Zapier, just because there's no native integration or the integration doesn't go in the way I like it.
Okay, I always find that it tends to be Zapier in the UK and Zapier in the US. But you're, of course, originally from the UK, but
I am,
having spent some time in the US
everything.
As well.
So. Yeah, it's a mass confusion. I pronounce all kinds of words wrong. People are just blown away. They don't know where I'm from. So
it's just different, not wrong. Yeah. Yeah, so Zapier is one of these tools that seem to have set an industry standard in terms of what people use. There are other alternatives out there, but they certainly don't seem as prominent or significant, and perhaps covering as many different technologies as Zapier does. Do you find that? I mean, I spoke to a gentleman called Charles Delisi from Plezi for episode number 8 of MarTech Stacked, and he recommended Zapier as well. And one of the thoughts that I shared with him was what can happen is that people create too many zaps and it becomes too complicated, and there's a danger, I guess, in just everything getting too complicated. Do you maybe once every 6 months or a year or so review the number of zaps that you have and turn off ones that aren't as important for you now?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. There's a thing I've spoken about before with people, which is this concept, you know, in tech, you've got this concept of technology debt and engineering debt that's to do with software development. And, you know, there's patches and you do things that are quick fixes to make things work the way you want them to. And I think marketing is the same way. We've got, you know, marketing debt from all kinds of things. And Zapier is great at that, along with your CRM, which we'll talk about as my number one choice for obvious reasons. But the whole concept behind Zapier is that thing. And I'm very conscious that there is a sort of duct tape version of like how things connect together. And there are times where, you know, you've got to look at what you're connecting where and to evaluate, oh, actually this company now has a native integration with these two pieces. So it's actually best to eliminate Zapier entirely. But one thing I think that's really important when you're using Zapier is to have, you know, the level of access that allows you to segregate where the zaps are and make people accountable for owning those things. So we have to, you know, each of the different departments, Global App Testing has their own folder and their own zaps. And there's kind of one key user who's in charge of that. This is relatively new for us when we moved to this model. I used to be the owner of all the zaps, which is not scalable in any way. And so then you move to a point where, you know, people are owners of those things. And yeah, you can just, you know, jump in every now and again, turn a few off and see if people's workflows break. and you soon find out if it's useful or not, because people either message you or they don't, and it just dies away.
What happened to our website? It's disappeared.
Yeah. It's completely gone. It's completely gone.
So that's Databox tool number three, Zapier tool number two. You mentioned CRM, and interestingly, many people have mentioned CRMs as their number one tool. So it does seem to be the most important in most organizations. What is your CRM?
So we use HubSpot.
Okay.
So, and actually it's a bit kind of a misnomer to say CRM is the most important thing. I think the CRM side of it is the most important for the sales marketing alignment side of things. Absolutely. But we are all in on HubSpot. So I've been using HubSpot since before Global App Testing as well. And I think the flexibility and the functionality of HubSpot is much further ahead than it was maybe 6 years ago when I was using it. But they're continuously growing it and building it as well, which is huge. And I've used Salesforce in the past as a CRM, not a Global App Testing. And the difference between the two, I think, is absolutely night and day. But in a similar way that, you know, the marketing technology landscape has changed. If you wanted to build a landing page 5 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer than that, you'd need, you know, some decent access or some decent knowledge to HTML, CSS. You'd probably need to know a little bit about hosting, or if you're building it in WordPress, something like that. But now, anyone on my team can create, you know, landing pages within HubSpot within 30 minutes, 40 minutes. A landing page is good to go. There's automations, there's nurture emails. Everything's aligned to the company brand. There's no, everything's been tested already. And so I think that what HubSpot's allowed us to do is to accelerate much faster with regards to those kinds of things and cut the amount of time it takes for someone to learn all of our systems, because everything's housed in one neat, orderly place.
Okay, so you introduced HubSpot to begin with as a CRM, and certainly you can just use HubSpot as a CRM, but you also mentioned landing pages and nurture emails as well. So I would assume that means that you use HubSpot for that as well?
Yeah, so we actually have, with HubSpot, we've got the marketing automation platform, we've got the sales and CRM side of the house as well. And I think the only thing we don't use from them is their customer support tool. And I'm sure that they would get us on it at some point if they could. But for now, you know, everything we do is flows through those two systems. And that means that there's really clear alignment on leads. There's very clear assignment or alignment around who's following up. We can be involved in the process as a marketing team. We can glean insights from what the sales team are doing with people in the CRM as well. And it's all one interface and one reporting system as well, which you know, provides multiple benefits, of course, across the org.
So do you use HubSpot for your CMS, for your main website as well, your main pages, and also a blog as well, I presume?
Yeah, we've got the blog, we've got the full website. When I first joined Global App Testing, we had a separate WordPress site. And, you know, the thing about having a separate WordPress site is that you've got to have someone that's maintaining that. And so the time and effort to maintain a WordPress blog and site means that you're diverting resources away from demand and driving growth. And, at an early stage startup when I joined, that meant taking time away from those efforts to maintain a website. And so you can either invest in that or you can invest in growth opportunities. And I said, look, let's really analyze this and put the resource into there, have HubSpot maintain those things for us, SSL, maintaining, you know, the uptime, maintaining security, those kinds of things. And we can focus instead on just content creation. And that's where I think our biggest win has come from.
Okay, so that, I think there's definitely value in doing that. I think a concern that a few people might have is in areas like SEO, because if you use WordPress, then at least you have access to lots of different plugins and you can really control the way that search engines sees your website. How has your SEO success been since you've just focused in on HubSpot?
Yeah, I mean, we have not had any issues with SEO. Our traffic's grown 300% over the last 3 years, so 100% year on year every year. And part of that is because HubSpot also has great SEO themselves, and they use their own platform for that. And so they really understand how important that can be. It wasn't as easy probably in the earlier days, I would say, for the CMS side of things, but they know that people, especially if you're selling to marketers and you're providing them with a tool, you know that we're going to care about those kinds of things. And, you know, there's actually a surprising amount of depth that you can get into the HubSpot CMS without having to compromise on SEO type things. And I think, you know, what you said about plugins is really interesting because, yeah, it is very easy to, oh, I'll just quickly download a plugin, or I'll just quickly add this, or I'll just quickly add that. And that introduces a whole raft of vulnerabilities and security issues that I prefer we not dive into as a company. And, you know, it's difficult on the HubSpot, on the WordPress side to really kind of lock it down from that perspective. Mm. Whereas with HubSpot, there's no kind of rogue malicious things like, you know, plugins that you can download and you can add on. But we do use an agency we've used an agency to redesign and design our site a couple of times now. And there's code, the specific HubSpot code that you can do, but you know, you can build reusable modules that you're dropping and dragging in, and it makes things really, really easy to build out.
So I'd like to talk a little bit as well about your own content marketing strategy. So what you publish on your HubSpot CMS. How regularly do you publish on your own website? What kind of content do you publish? And what kind of strategy do you follow for your content marketing?
It's a great question. So we've got a couple of different things, I think, that will answer that question. As far as how often do we publish, I've always tried not to say it's definitely this number of posts per week, or it's definitely this amount of time, because I always felt that, and I do still feel that it's important that if you don't have anything to say, don't just publish something for the sake of it. And then as far as kind of like a strategy goes, luckily for us, we don't have a dearth of things to publish. But there is decidedly kind of like three bucket areas, I would say, that drive the content strategy. There is the standard kind of SEO type content where we're answering a very specific SEO type query that is good for search engine optimization. It's good for backlinks. It's good for people wanting to search for us. And then we divide that out by persona. So we'll look at who our buyers are, who the target audiences, what they might be searching for, and then craft content to those types of personas. But it's decidedly more SEO, you know, how to X this, or, you know, those kinds of things. Then we also look at the kind of the things that our buyers might be interested in reading about from a technology perspective, how we solve specific problems. We've got a great couple of resources in-house. You know, we sell to, tech leaders, heads of engineering, CTOs, those kinds of things. So our CTO, director of engineering, is always interested in providing his thoughts around what engineering leaders want to read about. So then we can craft content that really addresses their pain points in their day. And it might not be something that they search for, but if they're on LinkedIn and they see a post that's talking about engineering leader burnout, for instance, they're like, I really struggle with that. I'm going to read this because it's interesting and it really hits the nail on the head. And we do that by persona as well. So some of it is for the buyer, some of it is for the influencer as well. And then we have our thought leadership piece. So we wrote a book about 2 years ago. It was about a year ago. It took us about 2 years to write. Every book is always, we're going to write this in 6 months, 2 years later.
Yes.
And so we have a lot of thought leadership about what the future of QA looks like and what the future of, delivering great, great quality software is. And so we interviewed 120 different engineering leaders from companies like Reddit, New York Times, eBay, Etsy, all the big guys. That's like, you know, how does it work in your, how does QA work and how do you release great products? No agenda. It was other than writing a book, really. That was the agenda. And, you know, we got some really great insight. We compiled that into a book called Leading Quality, which became a bestseller on Amazon. And what that's enabled us to do is it then provides an ongoing stream of thought leadership content that we can repurpose. We can write about, and again, break that down by persona. So, you know, leading quality as a frontline employee in your organization, what does that mean? is different than, you know, what it means to be a CTO and lead quality in the company as well. So we try to tackle it from three different areas and then break it down by persona.
Great. Yes, I published a book about 6 months ago and I interviewed 134 marketing experts on what they thought was the most important thing to think about over the coming year and incorporate within a business. And I did that as a result of doing a live stream and doing an 8-hour live stream. So did you incorporate video and audio into the content, into the conversations that you had with these people and use that content as well? Or were you just focused on the written word?
We were just focused on the written word. Yeah, I think, you know, retrospectively, we probably could have recorded in like video interview type sessions. But I think, you know, what we've done since then is invite those people onto our webinars. So, you know, we'll have webinars with the people that are featured in the book to talk about various aspects of what they talked about in the book. And so that's been really fun as well, being able to kind of get those same people back in to do webinars after the fact as well, and then relate it back to the book. But we use the book as a lead source and as a lead generation tool as well. And we just give it away, basically. I mean, you can buy it on Amazon; it's a bestseller. But ultimately, our salespeople use it as part of their pitch as well.
It's a wonderful brand authority builder as well. People will remember you because of it. And if they don't intend to use you now, then hopefully they'll remember you in 6 months' time and then come back to you. You also mentioned webinars there as well. So does that mean that you view content marketing in the future as perhaps being more video-based than text-form?
I think if you'd asked me that 6 months ago, I would have said, oh, definitely. Yeah, most definitely. I think there is a certain amount of webinar fatigue and there's a certain amount of kind of Zoom fatigue that's hitting right now. I had an email today that in bold in the middle of the email in all caps was, this is not a webinar, it's an online digital event. You know, here's the Zoom link. And I'm like, okay, well, it's still a webinar, or it's still a Zoom call. You know, you can call it by another name, but essentially it's the same thing. So I think that, you know, depending on how things play out in the current situation and how much people's tolerance kind of either wanes or gets better, depending on the situation, I think we'll really shift the dynamics for webinars. I think that the people that figure out how to really get audience engagement into a webinar, truly audience engagement, will really kind of win the market. Zoom has been by default a winner in this, but not because they've, you know, delivered some and, you know, innovative way of, you know, getting people engaged in a call, but just because they were the best at the time, right? So I think there's
They were the most reliable, I think. Yeah. They were quite a traditional looking platform, although they're not that old a company. I think their video quality is reasonable and their audio quality is only just sufficient, but probably not for recording decent quality webinars quite often as well. And you mentioned webinar fatigue. I think that to a certain degree, when many other businesses, many other marketers come onto a type of communication or a platform, then that leads to the quality must go up. If the communications platform is fairly recent and not many marketers are on there, then to a certain degree you can almost publish anything. And if the audience
I think LinkedIn video is a great example of that. There was no LinkedIn video. Suddenly there was LinkedIn video, and it was very easy for people to just post a bunch of rubbish.
Yep.
And be quite successful off the back of that. And now it's very difficult to achieve the same kind of level of success.
Completely agree. I've had LinkedIn Live for the last year or so. And when I went live a year ago to 6 months ago, immediately I had a few hundred people that watched the live stream, a lot of interaction, and within 24 hours, 2,000 people viewing the video. Wow. Nowadays, I go live and I'm lucky maybe to have 10 people watching live and maybe 500 people watching the video afterwards. And it's not a hopefully a reduction in quality on my part. It's just I think there are so many other people doing it. Yeah.
But
you need to. It's not necessarily the medium becoming old or people becoming tired of the medium. It's differentiating what you produce and ensuring what you produce is more relevant, higher quality for the target consumer compared with other people out there.
Yeah, so I think outside webinars, video will continue to be an important function. And I think well-produced, high-quality video always has a role, especially when you look at just purely from the funnel. I think it's very easy, when you have a good video and there's a personality there and you see a real human behind a brand, I think people are like, oh, okay, that's who I might be engaging with at this point. Mm. I get it. You know, I can kind of see that a little bit behind the curtain. So I think there's always a place for high quality video, and people demand that. It's also different being strictly B2B. We're not creating TikToks. Trying to get people interested in software development testing through TikTok as a medium, for instance. But I think that, some of the more traditional video approaches will always have a good way of interacting with the right buyer.
I will claw myself back from biting anymore and going down too big a tangent and return to your use of marketing technology and global app testing and ask you, as the business grows, what's an example of a process that you currently do manually that you may wish to automate using marketing technology in the future?
I think that's a great question. I think one thing that to me is never as easy as it should be is working with like third-party writers or third-party contributors. I think, having external copywriters, the current kind of Google Docs, let's get something in there, let's write a brief, let's have that. And then, coming back in, adding comments and approvals, what stage is it in, who's looking at it next, those kinds of back and forths, I think need some improvement. I haven't run across a tool that screams at me and says this is going to make all of that so much easier. And I regularly brief content writers as well. We have content writers on staff as well, but we regularly brief content writers, and it's like, well, let's jump on a call, 30-minute call, and then we'll write a brief, and then we'll approve it in an invoice. And there's so much back and forth that has to be, there has to be a smoother way without just employing them.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I've used Trello boards quite a bit in the past, and I just feel that maybe it hasn't evolved as much as it could have done in terms of giving different people access to different aspects of the boards and perhaps other integrations as well, or other aspects of the tool that could have evolved. One recommendation that Lucas Zalesny gave me in episode number one was a tool called ClickUp, clickup.com. Have you heard of them at all?
I have not heard of ClickUp, no.
That's worthwhile considering. I'm looking into them at the moment to automate certain things, and it's a great... It looks like being a great platform to build virtual teams and different responsibilities for different members of the team there. So it's something to perhaps look into.
That sounds fantastic. I would definitely give that a shot, actually.
Great. No, okay. And it's not an affiliate link at all. Okay. And what is something that you have in mind that would be a wonderful piece of marketing technology that perhaps doesn't even exist yet, but you would love to see created?
So I think Google is doing some really interesting things with like predictive AI within Google Analytics, and taking a look at being able to query your Google Analytics in a way that makes sense from a logical conversational perspective. I would like to see something that isn't that takes a holistic view of everything and can give me answers around marketing and predictive things. Something that says, that is evaluating what we've done and is providing some evidence that says, well, you know, normally when you write a blog, you get X number of traffic, and this keywords outside of your normal keyword set that you've got in, SEMrush or Ahrefs, one of our SEO tools.
Yeah.
And we know what, and probably, because it's not as long as your other articles, adding some extra length here, adding some science and adding some kind of rationale behind, there's a lot of gut decisions I think that happen, like, I think this article needs to be improved. Okay, yes. Well, why? Well, it's got less traffic. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. We need to improve it. okay, well, why? There's no, you know, like that, that we'll add more words. But I think there's some room there for someone to develop a thing that takes all of kind of your marketing data and churns out some really interesting analysis.
Yes, there's definitely been, there's been a few people so far in the discussions that I've had in the series that have said a similar kind of thing, that they would like more direction in terms of this is what you need to write about today. It needs to be X number of words long, include X photos, a video, and this should be incorporated within your heading. Now just go ahead and write it. And that way they'll know definitively the quality, the volume produced should be head and shoulders above what else exists out there for that particular keyword phrase. Tools that you mentioned there, SEMrush, Ahrefs, you know, are great tools, but they almost give too much information sometimes, yeah. And it's difficult to decide what to
do. And they're also very walled in there, you know, like it's their analysis based on their tool set. There's very little kind of interior data that you're giving it. It's all kind of quite publicly available data that it's pulling from. So unless you're integrating your existing posts and integrating your existing things, it's very difficult for it to give you anything other than what it can give everyone else. So if everyone's got the same, you know, the thing that differentiates, I think, a lot of marketers is your own data. And if you've got your own data, then that's something that nobody else has. And the insights that you can produce, that I think is where a lot of the gold can come from. Like we evaluate our sales funnel and our marketing funnel using, you know, data from HubSpot and Zapier and Databox. And we can see when there's a blockage in the funnel and we can then dive in and evaluate that. But that takes a lot of work. There's a lot of things that have to happen there along that front, and it's quite custom. But that's our data, and that's what gives us a competitive advantage over somebody else.
Well, Nick, you've offered a lot of great advice and thoughts as part of our discussion. It's the kind of discussion that could go on, I'm sure, for much longer. But let's try and distill it down into one final thought. And I'll ask you, what would you say is the key takeaway for the listener from today's discussion?
I think the key takeaway is almost what I was just mentioning now, which is really having a good view over your own data. And evaluating how your content marketing efforts, evaluating how your marketing stack all contribute to the end goal. And if you're, you know, if you're measured by revenue and or the amount of contribution that you're as a marketer that you're delivering to the organization, then really you should be looking at where the funnel, where people are progressing in your sales funnel, where the blockages are, and then put your efforts on resolving those major blockages in the funnel. And you know, marketing automation now, you know, compared to 3 years ago, or the MarTech stack compared to 3 years ago, you can do that now relatively easily without needing to learn SQL or anything more complicated than that. So the more data driven that you can get, I think the better results that ultimately you have, because you've got your own data set to play with.
Superb stuff. Well, thank you so much for your time and your tips. What's the best way for the listener to find out more about you and what you do?
Just connect with me on LinkedIn. So it's just LinkedIn, Nick Roberts. You can search me up there.
Wonderful stuff. Thank you again.
All right. Thanks, David.
And thank you, dear listener, for joining us. If you haven't done so already, sign up for your free trial of Content Cal, plan, collaborate on, approve, and publish your content in one simple and intuitive calendar interface. Plus, check out all the other MarTech Stack show episodes over at contentcal.io. Also, wherever you're watching or listening to this show, let us know your opinion. What are the three most important marketing technologies in your business? Let us know, and we'll try and give you a shout out on a future show, or maybe even have you on as a future guest. Thanks again.